Hello, this is Esperanza Phoenix, and welcome to Unpacking Life's Crazy, a podcast about a lifetime of unfortunate, unusual, and enlightening experiences, and how some of us use humor and hope to survive mental illness. In our podcast, we discuss controversial and adult topics. We are all adults here. There will be swearing. Today's podcast is an interview with Johnny Korn, who is a comedian, an actor, a really talented guy, and also just a really decent human being, which you're going to hear in our conversation. The reason why this podcast is starting out kind of weird, I learned that Johnny suffered a medical emergency while driving for DoorDash, and he's in the hospital right now. He's had several surgeries. I don't yet know exactly what the nature of the emergency was or what his condition is, but a friend has set up a GoFundMe page. I encourage my listeners to please go to the GoFundMe page, donate whatever you're able to. I know these are hard times for all of us, but as I said, Johnny is a performer. That was his main source of income before this pandemic. Since the pandemic, his only income is driving for DoorDash. I imagine it's going to be very difficult in the coming weeks as he recovers from whatever this is, and his family could really use the help. So please visit the podcast portion of my website. You'll find a link there so that you can donate to help him financially as he recovers from this setback. Thank you. We have another interview, and I'm so excited to have Johnny Korn here. Hi, Johnny. How are you?
Everything's groovy.
Not as groovy as it could be, I'm sure, because of our current pandemic situation.
Sure.
Johnny and I kind of met because we share a very unique job. The official title was bubbleologist.
That would be true.
I mean, this is just one of your many jobs.
I was a bubble dude. I actually went and put kids in bubbles in different universes.
In different universes, yes. And Johnny, I think once you're allowed to do performances again, you're still a bubbleologist, right?
Yeah, I'm probably the... Yeah, for help us, I will be able to do this again at some point.
Right. Now, I left bubbleology because of my own physical limitations, but it's a really super cool and weirdo job, and it's really great to work with the kids. It's so fun to see their reactions to the giant bubbles. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. Oh, God. Are you kidding me? I love kids. I love bubbles. What could be better?
Who doesn't love bubbles?
Exactly.
Right. Bubbles are great. So, Johnny, tell us a little bit about what you were doing before the pandemic disaster.
I was acting. I had a commercial that was in the Super Bowl. Then I did a bunch of stand-up. Exactly on stage, actually. When that was all shut down, I was doing Shakespeare. But yeah.
You were doing Shakespeare. Wow. I was not aware that you did classical theater as well.
Well, I mean, the casting, so. they're fools. That's all I'm saying.
Well, you know, if you're one of those stage people, you find yourself on stage doing a great variety of things, like the bubble thing. I used to do live theater ages ago. I know that you've done quite a few smaller roles in films.
Reggie, Jesse Light, and myself were in a movie together.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's Halloween Bloodline. And so
I have to look it up.
Oh, it's a horrible movie. You really don't want to know.
So it's like a C-rated movie?
Oh, it's bad. But we're all in this movie. And Jesse and I are in it more than Reggie. Reggie gets killed pretty early on because he's black. So
of course.
Of course he gets killed. But yeah, I remember filming that. And it's a true story. We're filming it, and it's in Oakland.
Uh-huh.
And so I added Who Farted. They kept it in the movie.
Oh, my God.
Completely ad-lib. I just thought it would be funny to say that. And I saw the movie afterward, and I'm like, oh, that's actually in the movie.
You're like, I can't believe they kept that.
But now this is a weird universe.
I think I say that on a daily basis. It's also strange.
Well, and I had a couple commercials where I filmed it and it's not going to come out because times have changed. And so they're like, well, maybe not.
Yeah. Some things that were appropriate before the pandemic aren't now. You know, like my daughter is working on a series of dystopian novels. Dystopian isn't selling real well right now, you know?
You know, it's weird. We're in the middle of something,
uh-huh.
But like, we don't know where it's going to end or where the new world will begin.
Right.
But we're in the middle of something that we're not able to see through.
Right. Okay. And I think that is the hardest part. When I get down, the hardest part for me is that I can't foresee what's coming next or even envision it. And I'm one of those people that when I get down, it's like I project to something I'm looking forward to, like whether it's a vacation that's 6 months out or a holiday or whatever. I just kind of put myself, okay, well, this is coming to look forward to. But it's really hard right now because you can't even envision what Halloween is going to look like this year, you know?
Yeah, that or, well, Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas.
Right.
We don't know what's going to happen then. And that, I can't do that, but it's going to happen.
Yes.
And it's okay. Like, we're just living through history now.
That is very true.
Hey, I'm actually in my bedroom.
I'm in my bedroom as well, but I have my camera off because I couldn't find my bra.
So? Neither could I.
So I decided to spare you that trauma and not turn on my camera.
Yeah, I have my camera on. I tell you, brand new computer.
Nice. I know you were computerless for a while there. I was a little worried about you, but I'm glad you've got connection now.
Well, all I had was my phone for a while.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking to myself, I kind of dig this. It's like,
But the nice thing about having a computer, you can get your voice out there a little better. So frustrating for an actor when you can't perform. And I know from some of your posts that, you know, you've been down a little bit lately. And, I mean, we all have. I think we've all been dealing with low-level depression. Michelle Obama talked about it, too. You know, we're all in this weird place and our normal outlet are taken from us. And especially if you're one of those people who likes to get out there and perform and make people laugh and all of that. And now suddenly you're kind of trapped in your own little bubble.
Well,
it's demoralizing.
Well, to that end, I was a guy. My skill set is not meant for this world at all.
Right.
Like, I would work through my problems by doing stand-up on stage and talking about it and just being, this is what I'm going through, and make fun of myself.
Right.
That's how I would deal with things. Now I can't act. I can't do bubble shows. I can't do stand-up.
Yeah.
So that's been hard.
Well, I appreciate you coming and talking to me in this format about that, because I do have many friends who are also comedians and musicians, actors. I have many friends that fall in that category, and you are all really struggling right now. I have musician friends who are putting on, you know, concerts in their living room, you know, trying to get some viewership there and getting people to maybe Venmo them some money because, you know, let's face it, we are in a capitalist society. So on top of the emotional outlet that comes from you just being able to do what you do and bring joy to people, which, you know, we get a rush out of making other people happy. You know, giving other people enjoyment is, it makes us happy. It's what performers do. So there's that. Sorry about the noise in the background. Hey, quit it. My puppy had his testicles removed the Tuesday before last, and he's still got the cone of shame. And every time he tries to scratch, he gets that weirdo flappy noise in the background. Knock it off, dude. Really annoying.
My cat, I'll have you know, well, is asleep.
Oh. Yay, cat, for being asleep and not disrupting.
Yeah, but she knows.
You had a talk with her about this recording. And,
I said to her, I'm going to the other bedroom. You stay there. And she did. But she was asleep at the time, so I think okay. I'm not normally up. Now I'm usually asleep. I'm up all night writing, been asleep all day. In normal times.
Yes.
And,
well, performers, mostly that's kind of our schedule.
Well, yeah, because like I used to be up till 2 or 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd do stand-up. It would end at 1, talk to the fans of the show, then home at like 2, on a show high, so fall asleep at like 3 or 4.
Right.
Get up at 11 or 12 and rinse and repeat.
Yeah, that was pretty much my schedule back in my theater days. You'd have a show and then, you know, you'd either hang out with the audience or you'd chill with the cast or whatever. And then, yeah, and then it takes a while to wind down.
Yeah, man. Back when you can perform.
Right.
I'll get all night, like really all night, because yeah. I'm on a show high sleep when I could. And that was pretty good.
Besides, when you're a performer, nothing's going on before noon the next day anyways.
Well, that's true, too.
Right?
Except rehearsal.
The way your schedule works out, like in theater, unless you're on tech week or something where you're rehearsing. So how are you getting through this? Because like you said, you had a lot of stuff lined up. Weren't you going to do like a comedy tour situation too?
Yeah. Well, that got canceled.
What was the plan?
Well, it's election year. So Richie and me, we were going to go like state by city, fly in two states. I don't call them pass over states.
Yeah.
We were going to do tours there and try to get out the vote. And
right.
It didn't happen.
Well, that's a noble cause and it sucks, but it was unable to happen. Since you were trying to get out the vote, what would your message be to voters now that you only have outlets like this?
And vote. I don't care. I do care. I'm a little bit biased. But I dig it. Vote for who you can vote for.
Mm-hmm.
But vote. It's extremely important. And look, if you're not registered and you're eligible, vote. It's your right. It's really important right now. And just, I'm all for doing your own thing, then, but it's important.
I would even say it is not just your right, it is your civic duty to vote.
Yes, yes.
So, and I'm going to be biased, I'm going to say it. Whomever you choose to vote for, please don't let it be Trump.
Hey, dude. I for Bernie, too. I was totally for Bernie.
Me, too.
But I'm totally for Uncle Joe.
Yeah.
It's awful. I'm not even high right now.
Aw.
I know.
It's hard times. It's scary times, too, because so many of our rights are being tested in this time with the Trump presidency. And it's scary for a lot of us, seeing some of the suppression of the media and, of course, all of the violence from the police. For me, it's a little bit baffling. I know that you're really following the Black Lives Matter movement.
Okay.
I am too. It's very personal for you, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But, you know, for me, I was very lucky to have been raised in a weird family where racism was not even a part of it. I didn't even understand racial biases. I didn't understand racial stereotypes. It was good. I actually do a storytelling thing called Growing Up Raceless. Until I was older, I didn't even realize that racism was really still a thing in the United States. I thought all that stuff was in the past. I hadn't heard the N-word except when my mom read out loud Mark Twain.
Yeah.
I didn't hear people using it. And then later, of course, I heard it in some rap songs and stuff like that. But I didn't think that it was so pervasive. And now just to see how much of it, I mean, Trump has made it acceptable for people to be publicly racist again. It's disgusting. And then as we have, you know, George Floyd's murder and the protests that rose up around it, you would think with the world protesting that the senseless murders would be stopping because they would realize that the eyes are upon them. Even under so much scrutiny, they can't stop that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like you to share with the listeners what your personal experience is and why Black Lives Matter so much to you personally.
Well, my wife is from the Caribbean, so I've experienced racial profiling in person. I mean, I'm a white dude, so I get that.
Yeah.
But I've been out with her,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen it happen in person, like her being followed. And I'm like, hey, can I help you?
No.
Well, we're in the airport, and she's randomly searched. And so she goes off to the side. So I go off to the side because I'm married to her.
Right.
And they're like, dude, you're a cool man. Like, well, I'm married to that chick right there. And they're like, okay, shock and awe and those things. So it's been part of my life, my entire life.
Right.
I'm a straight man. I have family that is not white.
Right.
Just how it is.
Yeah.
Jesus, Matthews.
So do I. I just don't happen to be married to someone who's not white, but but I'm about a quarter Native American. So on that side of the family, everybody's brown. I'm the white sheep of that side of my family.
Well, I am the Irish person on my side of them. Doesn't make sense.
So you do have children, though. So your children are not white.
May I say, I inherited two boys.
Oh, okay.
So Not as not the, the mom, I'm not the dad. What happened was their mom died of cancer.
Oh my gosh.
We kind of inherited them, but lucky for them and for us, their dad became very involved in their lives. I can't really, and no, they're not all white. That part is true. Oh, this is going off college. And we're having a hard time with that.
Yeah. Oh, that's rough. So your kids going off to college in any time frame is a scary time, but now yeah, especially.
My wife since she was 5, right?
Where are they going to college?
Scotland.
Scotland! Whoa!
I know. Like, don't want to get away from me. Want to get away with me.
Wow!
Like,
what a cultural experience, though.
Well, I mean, their biological father was Scottish. Oh, it was.
Yes. They're still there. They're still there.
Yeah, he still does. I mean, that's cool and everything, man.
They're kind of lucky to have been able to get there. I mean, aren't we kind of banned from Europe because we're all, like, plagued?
No, he has a British passport. But,
okay.
But he's going to have to isolate.
Oh, so quarantine the minute he gets there, yeah. I bet.
Well, Americans are germ testing.
We're like the rats of Europe during the Black Plague right now. We're just...
Yeah, man. He's going to have to isolate for a week, so everything's going to be online learning until, such time as they deem for more. Yeah.
That's a long ways away. That's rough. Mine, when she decided to go to college, decided to go to Michigan, which seemed a pretty long ways away from California. But Scotland's a hell of a lot further. She was able to get a scholarship and then in-state tuition, and so she got a whole lot better deal than to go here in California. Truth be told, she was dating this guy online, so she kind of, that was her main motivation. She tried to tell me it was all because it was the best school for her and stuff. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And at first I was like, you don't know anything about this guy. He could be like some troll in his mother's basement. You have no idea. So I stalked him on Facebook, and Josh actually, the first plus is he was a member of the marching band.
Oh,
yeah. Wow. Trombone, nice. Tenor saxophone here.
I did trombone and then trumpet, cornet, the baritone for a while.
Nice.
And then I moved on to drums.
So you're multilingual in music.
Yeah, well, I almost went to Berklee School of Music, but nurse had it, so...
That's okay. Nobody else can see it but me. He does a twitchy finger thing. It looks like he's trying to play the world's smallest violin at me.
I get really nervous talking.
Which is interesting because you decide to get up on stage and talk in front of huge audiences of people.
Well, I mean, that's different. I can get up on stage, bare my soul, and that's nothing.
Well, pretend I'm 30 people.
Yeah. If you're talking to one person, but being in an interview, interviews are torture.
Whatever works for you, man. I have a bunch of anxiety. And while I absolutely love being able to make people laugh and get on stage and all of that, like within the 5-10 minutes before I get on stage, I'm going, fuck, what did I sign up for? I am insane. Why did I do this? This is freaking insane. Why would I do this? And then it's like, but I'm signed up, so now I'm committed to doing this. The minute I step on stage in front of the mic, it's fine. But that few minutes right before I step on there, I am like, why am I doing this?
I have my tics. I do. I'm nervous before I go on stage, so I kind of stretch. And I have my... comedian friend, Reggie, who we go on tour together. And,
tell us Reggie's whole name in case anybody wants to know more about Reggie.
Reggie Shorter.
Reggie and Shorter.
He's like the tallest guy I've ever seen.
I was going to say, is he shorter?
Oh, hell no. He's like a foot taller than me.
Nice.
I'm short, he's tall. It kind of works out. People seem to be surprised like that they'll meet me and they'll go like, first off, you're short.
Hey, some of the best comedians are short.
I get it. If you look at me like with a bunch of other stand-up comedians, and when I would do Crepes to Laugh, when that was a thing, and it will be again, you would see me in group photos.
Right.
So it's like the shortest person.
Not but, if I was there, I'd probably be the shortest.
Maybe. You know, and this is a true story. I was in this movie, God, what was the name of it? Comedy of the Corn. It was actually Children of the Corn. It was actually a spoof.
Uh-huh.
Nothing to do with Austin.
at all. They had me stand on a crate, so I would be at least decent level with everybody else.
Hey, you're with great company. I hear Tom Cruise has had to stand on crates in almost every leading role he's ever been in.
I don't doubt that. I don't. Anyway, so we were doing the African-American circuit this time last year. I was like the token white guy. Uh-huh. Doing these shows. But I'll be always off to the side, like stretching out and really nervous to get on stage and all that. And then go on stage and I'm like, those shows I would talk about Donna, my wife. Uh-huh. I would talk about her and having a Caribbean life and making jokes about her. It seemed to work.
Well, it makes you relatable. It helps them realize where you're coming from because, and I've noticed that too with all this kind of like racial strife going on. I make a point when I pass a person of color to smile at them and be friendly so that they know, hey, I'm not one of those assholes. I'm approachable. I'm a human being. I see you as a human being. I'm making eye contact. I want you to know that we're cool because there are a lot of assumptions being made and I don't want to get mistaken for a Karen.
Right. Well, neither do I. I'm Karen. But in all truth, like, man, I mean, when times are normal and I'm in a room and everybody's white, I was more uncomfortable with that than it was diverse.
Right.
Just how it was. So I'm like, God, I'll be white people.
I have a question for you. Have you ever been in one of those situations and had some racist white asshole assume that you're like them, talk to you some racist shit?
Oh, yeah. And it didn't take long before I started making fun of them.
Good for you. Yay.
I just, I'm one of these guys that, like, okay, that's uncomfortable. I'm going to put some humor to it. I mean, I put humor to everything. When I was a teenager in high school, I was a short kid and not particularly popular. So I would just make fun of myself, right?
Uh-huh. Self-deprecation.
Yeah. So I get into situations where people assume, particularly when I was younger and before I met Donna. They know about Donna now, so it happens to us. They would do these racist jokes and stuff like that, and I'm like, not feeling it.
Yeah.
So I would actually turn around and make fun of them.
Good for you. And that takes balls when you're short and in high school.
Well, I mean, I am 150 pounds, right? Not a big guy. So I have balls.
That's about 50 pounds of it.
It's
the testicles.
So I would go, I'd make fun of them, and I'd go, like, that's funny. Really? You find that funny? The other thing funny is, and then I would make fun of them.
Good for you. Yeah, I remember I was sitting at a bar in Angels Camp. I used to live in Angels Camp, if anybody knows. It's the home of the Jumping Frog. Yeah. That's their claim to fame. It's their Jumping Frog Jubilee once a year, thanks to Mark Twain and his celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. But there was like exactly one bar downtown and was often filled with racist rednecks. And I had gone down to the bar just to be around people. Unfortunately, it's not a nice selection of people, but anyway. So I'm sitting at the bar, I'm having my drink, and this guy next to me decides to say, hey, look at that Mexican there at the end of the bar. You should go back where it came from. And I look over, and I see the guy sitting at the end of the bar. And like I said, I'm Native American, and I grew up traveling the powwow circuit. So that guy was not a Mexican. Not that Mexicans should go back anywhere anyways, but I look at the guy and I'm like, you're right. People who aren't from this country really should go back to where they came from because that guy is Native American. Where do you think you're from?
I remember, I don't know if it's Reading or Red Bluff or what city it was. I got hired to do stand-up and I'd show up to this bar. There's a giant like Confederate flag, like the biggest one I've ever seen.
Jesus.
And so I'm like, oh shit. I mean, this place is crazy.
That's scary.
So I go up and I did a riff for like 30 minutes on the Confederate flag and hey, celebrating coming from second place.
Nice.
Yeah. So I did that. Balls, I tell you.
My first experience with, I guess, yeah, my first experience with being in an interracial relationship. Again, race is just a myth, but
it's a construct.
It's a social construct designed to discriminate against people. But
yeah.
Anyways, that is the vernacular that we use. When I was in live theater, this guy showed up at the theater, and I swear the moment I heard his voice, I was already like, who is this guy? He was there for an interview for a show. Just gorgeous, funny guy. And it was at that time when there was that movement to go, people weren't going to say black anymore. They were going to say African-American. Right. And it goes back and forth. The terms always change. I'm hoping we can have a movement and change it to pigmentally gifted. At the time, so they were going through this African-American thing. And so Ronald and I started dating. And this friend of mine is like, oh, so your boyfriend's African-American. And I'm like, no, he's Jamaican Canadian. Because he was. His family had immigrated from Jamaica to Canada. And then he had actually come from Canada to California. And that's when we met. And it was really weird. And like I said, I was raised just not understanding racial stereotypes. I just thought he was funny and gorgeous. And we started dating. He's the one who kind of introduced me to this bias that was going on that I couldn't see. Like, we'd go out to the mall or something, and he'd say, yeah, those people are staring at us because we're a mixed race couple. And I'd say, no, they're staring at us because we look good. I just didn't, really get it. And the one time to this day, I cringe about it. I feel really bad about it. It was a completely innocent thing. And I accidentally really hurt him because we were going to a potluck for the theater. We had a large cast show. And so we were all getting together. We're going to have a potluck. And so we went to the grocery store to pick something up for the potluck. And, people bring chips or whatever. And I wanted to do something different, bring something different. So we're kind of wandering around the perimeter of the store trying to decide what it is we're going to pick up and take to the potluck. And we go through the produce section. And I'm like, well, why don't we just bring the watermelon? That'll be easy. We just pop it in the fridge and take it. And he got this look of just hurt and devastation on his face. And he says to me, oh, I bet you just love to see me carry that out of the store. And I was like, well, you don't have to carry it. You could leave it in the cart. What is wrong? He just looked at me confused for a minute, and it took him a moment. And he's like, you don't know what I'm talking about, do you? And I'm like, you don't like watermelon? We don't have to buy watermelon. We could get something else. And he had to explain to me the whole stereotype about that. I really had no idea that that even existed. And that night, he rented Blazing Saddles for me as a form of education. Because like I said, Ronald was hilarious. He was funny. And he actually used to throw out lines from Blazing Saddles all the time, which I was clueless about because I'd never seen the movie.
One of my favorite movies.
I know. It's the best. Mel Brooks, thank you so much for Blazing Saddles. And that was my first introduction to so many of these stereotypes. But he introduced me to that with humor. And I'm really glad he did, because unlike you, I didn't grow up around a lot of people of color. I met people all the time. We had friends and stuff. But I wasn't exposed to them in situations where I experienced what they were experiencing, So I hope I can cut out my dog and his bone chewing at the beginning of the interview. My goodness, there's a reason his name is Chewie. Actually, there's two reasons. One, we're big Star Wars fans. He's the same color as Chewbacca, and he chews on everything. So,
well, a Chewie story. Reggie and I were on tour. We were down in the Los Angeles area. Reggie's like, let's go to the Hollywood Walk of Fame. I'm like, I've been there. He goes, I haven't. we'll do this. Fine. So we go there. And the very first mission of his was to find Eddie Murphy. And he did. But we came upon Chewbacca, full costume. And he's going like, dude, take my photo, man.
Nice.
And I'm like, all right, man. I got this. I think it. So I take his photo. Maybe I'll post this later. His picture with Chewie.
Nice.
And so he had this picture taken, and like, that made his day. He was like,
he was on a high.
Oh God, he was on a high. I met Chewie today.
That's so cool.
It's not that it's not chewy.
Yeah.
Like, dude, it's cheese.
Right, soup.
No, don't bring me down for my time.
No, I'm going to believe it's the real dude.
Right. I love road trips. I miss my road trips.
I bet, yeah.
He's the one person, like, we get into road trips, and, yeah, he became my comedy partner. We go out there on road trips, and we wouldn't actually even fight at all. Like, we got on so well, and we'll get on so well when this
That's
is
That's great.
Up. Well, I'll say this. When I go on road trips with Reggie all the time, well, not now, but I would always drive because we get pulled over. I have my life privilege.
Right.
And so I can actually then talk to the cop. Like when Donna and I have been pulled over, my wife, Donna, when she and I would get pulled over, which is not that often, but when it happened, we both have our hands on the dashboard. And then I would actually do the talking. She would not say anything. It was understood that I would use my white privilege to get either out of the situation or handle the situation. It's weird because I am middle-aged white, so I can get away with pretty much anything. I know I have white privilege.
Yeah.
Not my fault. I was born white and am now middle-aged. And I know I can get out pretty much any situation if I talk to them and just deal with them and be groovy. But there's other people where if this wasn't my skin color, exact same conversation would look completely different.
Right. I think we're seeing way too many examples of that right now.
Oh, yeah.
And it's sad that we live in a world where an encounter with the police is different for you and I than it is for your wife or your friend Reggie. And that right there is the problem. That's the problem.
And I don't understand why people would still see that. And I mean, I've grown up around it, so I kind of understand more than most.
Uh-huh.
But I'm also a middle-aged white guy, right?
Yeah.
So why should I? I mean, it's great that I do, but my personal experience just being around people of color makes me aware of this.
But we are in the minority of white people who have enough friends and family of color to have experienced it and to hear them and to understand those differences. And what I'm hoping, is that this massive outpouring in Black Lives Matter is finally awakening those who don't have one black friend to what the situation is. You know, this is what it is. Recognize your privilege, understand what's going on for the rest of us. And then, are you really okay with that?
Well, and also point out, you're white, great, you won the lottery. Hey, yep. Congratulations. But you also, it's okay to admit that you have privilege over people that are other races. It doesn't make you less of a person. In fact, it doesn't make you less of anything, right? You were born how you were born. That's fine. I was born son of a university professor, author, and my mom was RN, registered nurse.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't change you, right? Admitting this is who you are, this is what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It does make you less of a person.
I think the problem is there are too many people in this world that believe that because they came out of the white vagina of a rich woman, they somehow deserve the privilege that they have. And they don't understand the struggle that people have from that moment of birth based on things they have absolutely no control over. Socioeconomic factors, the color of their skin, what country on the planet they happen to be born into. It was a roll of the dice where you were born and to whom you were born to.
That's a very good point. In fact, if you were born in the United States or Canada or UK, you won the lottery.
Okay. Yeah.
It doesn't matter what race you are, you won the lottery. Now, if you're white, you actually won the lottery.
Yeah.
No matter if you're working class or if you're upper class, it doesn't matter, you won the lottery. Now, that said, don't you want people that are maybe a little bit more tan than you, a little bit more pigment? Don't you want them to have the ability to walk down the street and be able to come home?
Yes. And the thing that really upsets me when people say, oh yeah, but Blue Lives Matter. Okay. When a person chooses to be a police officer, they have made a choice. They know it is a dangerous line of work. they put on that uniform knowing that that puts them at risk. Right. And at night, they can go home and take that uniform off and walk in their plain clothes down the street. Nobody necessarily knows that they're a police officer. They have made a choice in their career to put themselves in that danger. When a person is born of color, they don't make that choice. A little black boy walking down the street should not have their life at risk simply because of the color of their skin. They cannot take off their skin color. Why are they a target? And when you come to a situation where it's the cops and a person of color, I'm sorry, but I know people are going to think this is controversial, but more cops should be killed in confrontations than unarmed black people, because those cops chose to put on that uniform. They chose to put themselves in danger. An unarmed black child didn't make a choice. They're just trying to live their life.
Right. And I grew up with privilege. I grew up in a lower middle class neighborhood, but I was upper middle class. So I already have that on others. Because my dad was a professor and author. He would tour. It was a very interesting life. My childhood was unusual. But I was born. Both parents happened to be of Irish descent. My grandparents were Irish. I grew up pretty white, I guess. I go out to the car and I don't put sunscreen on. I tumor. That's how white I am.
You're pigmentally challenged.
Exactly. But I also was lucky enough to grow in a very diverse neighborhood.
And with parents who didn't impose that on you, apparently.
No, actually, my dad, my dad would be like, think about the other. Think about like how, and my dad was a Republican. I mean, like, this is before Republicans became special crazy.
Yeah.
He was like, you know, physical responsibility. And he'd also be like, yeah, you know, that, think about it from the other person's perspective.
Yeah.
Always put yourself in the other person's shoes.
Yeah.
I always did that because like, I have the ability to do that because of my dad. In fact, my dad and I didn't get on when I was younger. So when my dad became sick, we used to sit down and talk on the porch. We had there's a bench there, and we used to talk and we discussed like whatever the events of the day were, and we would talk about like politics and we talk about like race and all that. I value that to this day, and not just because he passed, but because it made me a better person. That means of thinking about things from a different perspective.
Right.
You take one side of an issue, I take the other side of the issue, and then we switch.
Playing devil's advocate.
Right. You know, you as people do. I mean, like, it took me a while before I was cool with him, because, like, everybody knew who he was. I was his son.
Yeah, that's a little hard when you grow up in a shadow.
Yeah, I was definitely in a shadow. But now people know who I am and don't know who he is.
The rules have reversed.
Yeah, well, I mean, oh, wait, shit, that was your dad? I'm like, yeah, that was my dad.
You know, I think if you could pare down the problems of our country into one single nutshell issue, I think the biggest central problem is a distinct lack of empathy.
That's exactly it. And if we can just go for the other, I know my big issue in all times was food insecurity.
Yeah.
And I would actually lecture different places with that. Talk about we don't have a food issue. We have a food distribution issue. In fact, what's interesting, I would talk about that. Some of the Trump supporters that are like totally against me on the page and like upset with me on pretty much every issue, I met them through food insecurity and them on the same topic as me. We agree on that. There are areas where we agree, and where we agree, let's change it.
Yeah.
Change the conversation now.
But if you can put yourself in another person's place, I mean, if it's because they're in a different socioeconomic situation or different skin color, or they speak a different language, or, you know, whatever it is, just imagine yourself in their position. How would you feel? How would you feel if your child just got gunned down unarmed by a police officer? How would you feel?
That's just it, man. You just got to put yourself in the other person's place and realize we're all just trying to get through this life. We're trying to get through all this.
I'm from a very, very white county, Wyoming County. And of course, I'm friends with the people who are showing up in our little tiny courthouse park and doing Black Lives Matter demonstrations. But there, it's really interesting because it is a mostly white county. So out of that whole group of people, there's probably what, 5 or 8 or 10 people of color in the entire group.
Well, I will say this about Campbell, my hometown, where I live is mixed, but the Black Lives Matter, you go out to the intersections, Campbell Avenue or Hamilton Avenue or whatever, all of them are white.
Yeah.
And it's Black Lives Matter, which is great. I mean,
yeah, it's wonderful.
When you get the white people on your side.
That's what it took for civil rights to get through, is exactly. For people to finally get outraged and those who have the privilege to say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't cool. And that's what you need to get that tipping point.
Now, you get into my apartment complex. That's a different story. I have so many different languages spoken here. I can speak Korean a little bit.
Oh, nice.
And I can speak Spanish a little bit. And it comes in handy. There's some languages I honestly don't know.
I have a lot of trouble with the Asian languages. The sounds are so incredibly unfamiliar to me.
Well,
I'm sure if I tried really hard, I could probably, you know, get a few phrases. But I grew up around the Latin languages, so that's way easier for me to get the sounds and figure it out.
Well, in my defense, I took Spanish in high school, so there's that. I worked for a Korean restaurant when I was 13, 14.
So that was your immersion.
Well, there's that. And then I also used to babysit for a Korean church. So I was in their daycare and doing the daycare thing.
Oh.
And they didn't speak English much there. So it was like immersion.
Right.
I learned terms like get down, stop, stuff like that.
Be quiet.
That was my immersion. That was like the first words I learned.
Well, the other weird cultural experience for me is my best friend's parents. They met in the Peace Corps. Her father was the second guy ever to sign up for the Peace Corps. So they actually met in Africa in the Peace Corps.
Oh.
So both white, but their house was decorated with African shields and spears and artwork, and we had a baby doll that happened to be black. It was kind of a multicultural understanding in their household. And as soon as she was born, they started the adoption process and adopted a little girl from Korea. And Holly came around Christmas, and she was 3. So she was Korean, but we never understood a single thing she was saying because, of course, we were trying to get her to learn English. When Holly was, I want to say, 13 or so, the whole family moved to Korea. Her father worked in the military, so he was able to do a transfer so that she could get a better understanding of her culture. And then my childhood best friend was able to learn Korean. But when she came back, the only word I learned from her that I still remember is bulgogi, which apparently is the Korean word for barbecued dog. That was her nickname for my dog, so that's all I know. And I don't think it's very useful in conversation.
Right. Well, I what's interesting is with pretty much every language, I understand what they're saying.
I think that's how all of us are. Certainly when you start learning, you understand more than you can say back.
Right. I don't feel comfortable speaking it because, like, any language except English. Because, I know Gaelic.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Well, that's my family. I understand it. Do I want to speak it? Not particularly.
Well, I speak Spanish only because we lived in Costa Rica for over 7 years in a small farming and fishing village. Basically, if we didn't learn Spanish, we wouldn't have spoken to anybody.
See, but my Spanish is so.
Okay,
I understand a lot more than I speak. And that's the same thing with Korean. I understand more than I speak.
That can also be very helpful in some situations, though.
Well, I used to drive Lyft.
Uh-huh.
When I drove Lyft, they were speaking whatever language they were speaking. And I'm like, I don't think I know what you're saying. then I'd answer them back in English. But
yeah, we would, when we were in Costa Rica, because sometimes they try to gouge the tourists.
Right.
And like we'd be taking a taxi and I'd be with my kids in the back, we'd be speaking in English. And then we'd get to our destination and the taxi driver tried to charge me 3 times as much. And I'd like whip out some Spanish. Ewe puta ladron. I'm not paying you, thief.
Right. Well, and it's funny. I think like language is kind of cool. I actually know someone that's First Nation
and she goes on her tours, well, one time to Nama, and she would talk about culture, and she was speaking her native language. And I'm thinking, like, that's kind of cool. You pass that down. You know that language.
Well, I would love to learn Navajo one day. I would love to.
Yeah, and she's fierce. She's like someone to be reckoned with.
Yeah, and I'm like the Heinz 57 of Native American. I'm a hodgepodge of the Southwest, but the most accessible and still taught language is Navajo.
Well, I'm like...
but you speak some Gaelic, and that's very impressive.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, that's... Hey, I mean, they call it Irish. If you actually talk to the Irish, they call it Irish.
The interesting thing, and it's really very sad, is when you hear about rednecks who barely speak their own language correctly, putting somebody down for speaking Spanish in a grocery store or something like that. I've even seen some idiot in Texas, two Navajo women were speaking, and they're like, speak American. It's like, excuse me,
we were
speaking this before you were.
Well, and the thing is, like, Columbus discovered America. No, he didn't.
No, he
didn't. Here already. Oh, God, he's such an asshole.
Yeah, I mean, I can't wait until Columbus Day becomes Indigenous People Day, like, all over the United States. That's what we need to have happen.
Right, right. Well, it's a holiday for getting lost. You got lost. He thought he was finding his way to India.
That's why they called us Indians forever, because he's an idiot.
Right, he's an idiot. And here's the thing, look, he honestly, his entire life, he thought that if he went to Asia. No, dude. You're in a whole different continent, man.
Didn't he realize that he didn't discover the spices he was said to pick up to begin with?
He's an idiot.
On so many levels.
The thing that bothers me as much as that is Andrew Jackson is on the 20.
Yeah.
Shouldn't be.
Why isn't Harriet Tubman there yet? Wasn't she supposed to be on the 20?
She was supposed to be, but Trump overturned that. If it was, and Tubman is impressive. But Andy Jackson, we'll call him Andy, ended up creating a small economy issue with his whole dissolving of the banking system we had at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to that, Trail of Tears. So it's like, all right.
Yeah.
And you just did a massive...
And the other thing, too, that we've heard about the Trail of Tears, I actually have, you know, it's kind of weird, but I have a children's story that talks about the equivalent that happened to the Navajo. It was called The Long Walk. And it was essentially the same situation as the Trail of Tears. And they marched them through the Rio Grande River to Fort Sumner. And the same basic situation as Trail of Tears happened to the Navajo.
Yeah. I mean, history of the First Nation repeats itself over and over and over.
Yeah.
And, now, what's weird, like, the Ohlone here in California have a different history altogether, but it's Spanish.
Right.
That's amazing. I mean, so...
Well, to get back to the topic of Black Lives Matter, I have to say, you know, people say, oh, this isn't America, but if you look at the history of our country, we are founded on genocide, slavery, exploitation, and the very foundation of our White House was built by slaves.
Right.
So, yes, that is America, and that's the problem. You know, our police forces were very much established to oppress the newly freed slaves. It's in our very foundation, these racist undertones.
It goes further than that. A lot of police departments, I'm not saying all, but a lot of police departments actually have white supremacists within the police department.
Oh, absolutely. That's 100% true.
Yeah. So you get the Proud Boys. It's like, until we get the racists out of the police department, I'm not saying all cops are bad, man. I know some cops that are fucking awesome. I know a detective in LA. I know two cops in the San Jose Police Department in all times. They came out to my show. I dig it. It's all good. This one cop I know, I've known him since he was a kid, like a child. He's a cop now. They chose him because he can speak Vietnamese.
Nice.
And they want him to come in his own community.
And that's great. That is one of the major problems that happens is you've got, if you had people from the community working on the force, policing the community that they live in and that they are from, we wouldn't have the situation going on that we do now. That's a, I mean, that's a big part of the problem. But like you said, we've got straight up racists and members of the KKK and everything else on this force, and they're not properly vetting them. When they apply, they should be having psych evaluations. They should be scouring their social media to make sure that they aren't racist to begin with. And they should be properly trained in how to de-escalate situations.
Well, you know, you get like military, and they're in some foreign country somewhere. And they're trained on de-escalation because they're like, okay, we got to get on with the locals. We have to be able to de-escalate a situation so it doesn't become something major.
Right.
And so why aren't the police doing de-escalation, right?
Yeah.
It should be all the de-escalation. Also, I'm sorry, if someone has a mental health issue, that's just not me saying this. Black Lives Matter is saying this. But also, a lot of police officers are saying,
right,
like, we're not equipped for this, man.
No, they aren't.
And we don't want this, right? And so if everybody agrees, then why isn't there mental health people for those people to de-escalate the situation? Maybe have a cop come out because of the situation, but have a mental health person also.
Right. Have the cop there in case it gets out of hand and they need to be there, but not as the main person dealing with it. And that's one of the things people don't understand about this cry to defund the police. We're not saying eliminate police departments. We're saying take the funding out of that, those weapons and all of that, and instead put it into the part that the police aren't handling, because more functional societies have less law enforcement problems to begin with, pay for more social workers so that they can deal with the mental health calls. You know, use that funding to make your community healthier emotionally so that there's not as much need for the police, because the police generally show up after the problem happens. They don't prevent it.
And the thing is, like, a lot of what Black Lives Matter is asking for, the police actually want also. It's like, we shouldn't be the ones coming out for that.
Right.
It should be really someone that's trained in mental health. The police should actually just handle what the police should handle, and that's it. Just like, if it's crime, great.
Yeah. If there's already been shots fired or somebody has a weapon, then okay, yeah, we probably need the cops there.
Yeah. There's a case where several years ago, and I'm going off my memory, so it might be faulty, but Nazi Police Department comes out, and a guy had a gun to a person that he was holding hostage. And they're able to talk this guy down, and they basically took him into custody. Well, that's the right thing to do, man. But you get into situations like, I'm pulling you over because your tags are expired, or tail lights out.
Right.
And you're reaching over to maybe get your license, which I asked you for. They're going to shoot you.
Yeah. Or you see them walking up to the car door before they've even asked for the ID, and they've already unbuttoned their holster and have their hand hovering over their gun as they approach the car window to ask about license and registration. It's like, excuse me, if you are so paranoid that you really think you're going to need your firearm every time you walk up to a vehicle, maybe you should not be a police officer.
Unless my voice is a little bit cracked up.
The smoke level here in California has just been so awful. And you got to be out in it in your job. Speaking of your job, I need to let you go so you can get to work. Oh my gosh, I've kept you so long.
And it's all good, man.
So tell me about the show you have coming and the date.
I'm actually doing a virtual comedy show. And so it has Reggie Shorter, who is my comedy partner, Nicole Tran. I'm headlining. And Juicy Delight hosts. Wait, I'm the only white person on that.
Again, the token white dude.
No, I didn't realize that until just now.
One white friend.
Yeah, but the nice thing about it is $10, it's an hour long, you get some comedy from a living room, or in my case, it might be the kitchen.
Or your tent, or your bathtub, you want to take a bath and laugh, then you can do that.
Yeah, so that's going to be a thing, and it's on September 19th, 8:30 California time.
September 19th.
8:30 p.m.
8:30 p.m. And folks, please, please, please put in your $10. You know, help this comedian out, because DoorDash is just pennies. Tip your dashers.
Yes, because we make as little as $2 per dash.
So that's my public service announcement for today. Tip your dashers. And thank you so much, Johnny, for coming and having this conversation with me. You're awesome.
Man, I appreciate that. And then I'll leave people with this idea for the day. Look,
We're all in a bad situation. So let me remind you that the best protection against identity theft right now is bad credit.
Thank you, Johnny. I will let you get to your dashing. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too.
You have an awesome rest of your day. If you want to learn more about that comedy show on September 19th, please visit the website. I will be providing links, and I'll provide links so that you can find out more about Johnny Korn, too. That's going to end the pod for today. Thank you so much for joining us for Unpacking Life's Crazy. Please like and subscribe to be notified when a new pod drops. And as always, if you're interested in learning more about this podcast, please visit my website, esperanzaphoenix.com. Last but not least, I would like to offer a special thanks to Chelsea Wild, the talented musician who composed the theme music for this pod. To find more of her wonderful original music, you can look her up on Instagram at minor.birds or visit minorbirds.info. That's minorbirds.info. Thank you so much for listening to the pod today. We hope you'll listen next time.